Jerry Pippin, and welcome to the Parazong. And we are, of course, talking with Jerry E. Smith today. He's co-author of a just-released book called Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend. I like that title, Jerry. It conjures all kinds of images.
Oh, cool.
Tell me, and welcome to the show, first of all. Tell me a little bit about the premise of this book. I know you're a 30-plus-year veteran of freelance writing and lecturing, so you've had plenty of experience.
I'm something of a gun for hire. I write books when people ask me to write books for them. And I pick and choose my projects because I always write about the same thing, which is the control freaks, those who do not believe that the average man is good enough to be able to enjoy liberty, that we have to be controlled. And so my first book for Adventures Unlimited Press was Harp, the Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, which is an expose of the high-frequency active auroral research program, which describes how the control freaks would use the most advanced weapons to take over the world. And in this one, Secrets of the Holy Lance, with my co-author, with George Picard, we talk about how people have tried to use metaphysical technology to take over the world for the last 2,000 years.
Now, George Picard, didn't he write some things about JFK?
Right. His previous book was Liquid Conspiracy, JFK, LSD, the CIA, Area 51, and UFOs.
Well, that's right down my alley. It covers just about everything, huh?
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about some of your past projects, but you're lecturing coming up here pretty soon somewhere. You're holding a little meeting.
Right. Adventures Unlimited Press holds two conferences a year. In the spring in Kempton, Illinois, which is about a two-hour drive south of Chicago, and in the fall in Cottonwood, Arizona, or Sedona, there's another. We have AUP bookstores all over the world. There's one outside of Toronto, one in Amsterdam, one in Auckland, New Zealand, and one in Kathmandu, Nepal. And so the one here in Kempton, Illinois, we're having the annual conference here May 5, 6, and 7. It'll be $120. If you want more information about it, go to WEX Club. That's the World Explorers Club website, WEXCLUB.com, WEX Club.
Okay, and we do have a link to that for people to find out about it. Tell me a little bit about this organization before we go any further.
Well, the World Explorers Club has been around about 20 years. It publishes it's supposed to be a quarterly, but I think we actually get out about 3 issues a year on far out adventures and far away places. And that's the baby of David Hector Childress, who's the owner. Publisher of Adventures Unlimited Press, and he travels the world. And AUP has been around, I think, 23 years. In that time, we have published about 150 books, of which around 120 are still in print.
What basically this organization sounds like is just a group of adventurers, I guess, that like to travel. And maybe many of them are just armchair travelers.
Right. We do a couple of escorted expeditions a year. David Hatcher Childress just led an expedition into the jungles of Central America looking for ancient artifacts and ruins. And they regularly go to Egypt and a variety of places.
Now, that's on that website, too, that information?
Exactly. So you can get our books from adventuresunlimitedpress.com and learn about the club and our expeditions at wexclub.com.
Let's talk a little bit about the Spear of Destiny legend. Tell me a little bit about what that is.
Well, the story begins with the crucifixion of Jesus the Christ. says that, as told in the Gospel of John and elsewhere, that as Jesus hung on the cross, after he had died, a centurion pierced his side with his spear to prove that he was dead. And a legend has arisen about that spear that, and I quote,
This is a spear that went into the side of Jesus?
Exactly.
Okay.
And the legend is that whosoever possesses this holy land,
kind of like the robe,
and understands the powers it serves, holds in his hand the destiny of the world for good or evil.
And where is the spear this time?
Well, that's a darn good question. What we have found is that there are half a dozen different objects scattered around the world that claim to be the spear. There's one in a church in Armenia, there's one in the Vatican, there's one in a museum in Vienna, there's another in a museum in Krakow, Poland. There may be one hidden somewhere in Europe.
Well, do you think any of those spears are the real one?
Another good question.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but it just... Yeah, you know, the Vatican, I'm sure, thinks they have the real one.
No, actually, they do not make claims about it.
Oh, really?
Right. They do not claim it is the real one, so I assume it's not. The one in the little church in Armenia thinks it is the real one, but it's not a spear at all. It's a Roman standard head. It's a flagpole top that looks like a spear. Then you have the one in Vienna. And the one in Vienna is the one most people are familiar with. Trevor Ravenscroft wrote a multiple million seller book in 1972 called The Spear of Destiny. And most people are familiar with The Spear of Destiny through that book. And yet, that object, probably was not it either. In 2003, Dr. Robert Feather, a British metallurgist, was allowed to perform some tests on it. And he and his team concluded that the ore in the iron spearhead had been forged about at the 6th or 7th century.
So too late.
Too late.
It seems to me there was a book out about the Hitler connection on this thing.
Oh, exactly. That's what Trevor Ravenscroft's book was all about.
Uh-huh.
It was about Ravenscroft's initiation into the occult, Hitler's initiation into the occult, and by extension, the reader's initiation into the occult. And so most of the book, Ravenscroft spent most of his book trying to figure out who Hitler and his cronies were in past lives. He maintained that they were, they were the characters in the play, the opera Parsifal, the inspiration, they were the real life characters that inspired those fictional characters, and that they had reincarnated to continue doing the evil that they had been doing a thousand years earlier.
And of course, this is kind of a theme we hear a lot of times about powerful people. I think Idi Amin claimed he was somebody else at one time.
He actually thought he was Hitler.
Yeah.
Idi Amin was born the day or the day after Hitler supposedly died. But neither George nor I believe that Hitler died in the bunker.
What do you think happened to him?
There was something called the Führer convoy, which was a convoy of submarines that left Germany in the last a day or two before the end of the war. And we have very good eyewitness that Martin Bormann was on one, and we think Hitler and his entourage were on the other.
Where did they go?
Argentina. In fact, in my book, or in our book, Secrets of the Holy Land, I found Hitler's home address in Argentina and put it in the book.
Now, did he live in a major city, or?
He lived in a little ski resort in Patagonia.
Okay. You know, the Israelis have been looking for him for sure. How come they never found him down in Argentina? I mean, we've heard these stories forever.
Well, they found one of his neighbors, Eichmann. They snagged Eichmann.
Yeah, I remember that.
Eichmann and Bormann and the Hitlers and several other of the top execs lived in the same town. And they were very very close with the Argentine government, and the Argentine government provided air cover for them, and they lived out their lives with only Eichmann getting popped.
I guess they're all dead now.
They should be. We're coming up on Adolf's birthday, which is April 19th, and if he were still alive, he'd be 116.
Yeah, he's probably well gone by now. I want to get back to the Spear of Destiny. It seems to me that someone, maybe it's your book, that says that the thing went down to Antarctica for a while.
Exactly. That's a major piece of the story. What we did in our book, Secrets of the Holy Lands, is we tried to nail down every piece of the spear legend. And then, having assembled the entire spear legend, we then juxtaposed it against known history and tried to sort out what really happened and what is just legendary, what is myth. And one of the great tales is that there was this American college professor who taught medicine at Tulane and LSU named Dr. Howard Buchner. And Buchner wrote like 240 textbooks on medicine, as well as a number of books on art history. And he, during World War II, he had been a battalion surgeon. And as a surgeon, he had gone, he was part of the group that went into Dachau prison. And he witnessed the Dachau massacre. What had happened was the U.S. Army, upon arriving at Dachau, took all the Germans into custody, put them in a spot, and then went into the prison to see what was there, and they flipped out. They were so incensed by what they saw, they went and they shot all the German prisoners. And Dr. Buchner was appalled by this, and he wrote a book about what he saw, and that came out about 84. And shortly after that, he was contacted by a submariner, a German submariner, who said that he had been in the Führer convoy, that he had been on one of the submarines that had taken, he had been on the submarine that took Martin Bormann to Argentina, and it then continued on to Antarctica, where they deposited 8 bronze boxes of Hitler's personal stuff that Hitler did not want the rest of the world to get. And this included the Spear of Destiny.
What else do you think was in that?
There are supposedly Hitler's ashes, which we don't buy. And there were some personal artifacts, like his scout badges, and his lucky coin, and his favorite.
So personal items, basically.
A couple of pieces of art that he was very fond of.
Well, the Spear of Destiny is not down there now, right? You think it's someplace in Europe? I take it.
This submariner went on to say that it was recovered in 1979, and he provided Buchner with the log of the expedition that recovered it and photographs of some of the things recovered, which Buchner then researched this and became convinced that it really did happen. That that during the war, Himmler had created had a Japanese swordsmaker make an exact replica of the Holy Lance, and it went on display in Nuremberg. While the real one was used by Himmler and his circle of black knights that he called the Knights Grand Council to do black magic with.
So what would they do with this spear? They would wave it around and actually cut themselves?
We don't really know.
I'm trying to figure out what the ceremony was there.
Nobody has come forward to reveal what was really taking place, because it's occult magic rituals.
Yeah, it's interesting that we're talking about something that has the blood of Jesus Christ on it, and it's being used by the essence of evil all through history.
Yeah.
Kind of a dichotomy of life, I guess.
Well, I'm not sure if it was really used by the essence of evil all through history, though, Like one of its wielders was Charlemagne, and Charlemagne is generally credited as being the greatest king who ever lived by having the most enlightened rule.
Yeah, you're right about that. And as a matter of fact, I'm a relative of Charlemagne, far distant. Charles Pippin the Fourth was in that group. So I'm not going to say Charlemagne was evil. let's talk a little bit about this whole essence of the idea that the sphere is someplace. It would seem to me that you would have these upwardly mobile, dictatorship-oriented, power-hungry, greedy, BS-type people would do anything to get a hold of this sphere. So it seems to me this little church that says they have it, have they ever been robbed?
I know they keep it under constant guard.
Okay.
They keep it hidden away. They only bring it out on very rare occasions. They're always very careful about who gets to see it, that nobody ever gets to touch it, yada yada. Again, it's probably not even a sphere, so...
Yeah, it's probably not the right one, but...
And then the one in the Vatican, they got tired of people arguing over it, and they stashed it in a rather odd way. One of the thrones that the Pope sits on has a decorative roof over it, supported by four pillars, and the sphere is walled up inside one of the support pillars.
Wow.
Yeah, they did that a couple hundred years ago. Apparently, there was just too much disputation as to what was going on, whether it was real or not. And somebody got the bright idea that we could stop people arguing just by stashing it.
I think your organization did some stuff on Atlantis at one time.
We do publish a great number of books, such as David Hector Childress has written a number of books on the subject of diffusion, which that there was a previous high-tech civilization that spread all over the globe, and that the bits and pieces that we see are really, that Egypt and Mexico and so forth were all spun from the initial culture.
One of my producers told me that he thought that NASA and the CIA had done some scientific testing on the sphere.
Well, it wasn't NASA or CIA, it was Dr. Robert Feather.
Okay.
Feather's team did their research in 2003. Now, one of the interesting things is that in 1988-89, Buchner said that the sphere was intentional, that the replica that was made for Himmler, that it was intentionally made out of materials from the time of Charlemagne, so that that it was intentionally made from iron forged in the 7th century. And then here we have 15, 20 years later, Dr. Robert Feather examines it and says that's what they found.
So to make a long story short, we do or do not know where the spear is.
Well, boy, do not. There is of course a question of are any of them legitimate? And George and I basically are in agreement that probably none of them are legitimate. But if one is, the Vienna one is most likely it. In fact, the one that went to Antarctica and is now stashed somewhere in Europe is probably it, if there is any at all.
You know, we started talking about Hitler and Nazis. Since I do UFO shows, I got to ask you about that. You hear about Foo Fighters and things like that. What do you know about Nazis and UFOs and Germany and World War II?
Oh boy! Well, you got 8 or 10 hours. I started researching this 20 years ago. 20 years ago, I became convinced that there was a legitimate question as to Hitler, whether Hitler really died in the bunker or not. So I started researching if Hitler got away, and in the process of that, I ran into the Nazi advanced aircraft, the disc aircraft, the Nazi flying saucers. And we put a bit of that, we put as much of what I know on Nazi flying saucers in the book, but, it's not a book about Nazi flying saucers, though I think there's all about 5 or 6 pages on the subject. Because, you know, it's a very big subject, you know, 2,000 plus years, and we only had 350 pages. There was a lot of stuff I wanted to put in the book that I didn't. One of the things that I found was very remarkable was that in 1938, Germany was massively expanding in some very odd ways. 1938 was the year of the Anschluss, in which Germany annexed Austria. It was also the year that they went to Antarctica and claimed about a fifth of the continent as a German colony. And they may have tried to actually establish a permanent residence in Antarctica, which we cover at some length in the book. They also came to Roswell, New Mexico, and bought hundreds of properties with caves, tunnels, and underground facilities. They were trying to get an underground base in Roswell, New Mexico, for God's sake.
They were doing this before the war?
Yes, all in 1938. And it's very possible that the Roswell crash was not an alien crash, but was a Nazi disc aircraft.
That's an interesting theory. How do they feel about that in Roswell, I wonder?
Oh, they laugh.
I want to talk to you about HAARP a little bit. I mean, you know, this is an amazing thing, and you're pretty much an expert on it, I think. The High Frequency Active Aural Research Project, I guess that's the correct name.
Auroral. They want to change the aurora.
Okay.
The aurora is caused by a flow of electrons.
We're talking about the aurora borealis, northern lights.
Right. The northern lights are caused by a flow of electrons from outer space called the electrojet. And one of the purposes, the primary purpose of the project, as embodied in the name, was to affect the aurora, to affect the electrojet. They were going to try to tune the electrojet, turning it into a virtual antenna tens of thousands of miles long to communicate with deeply submerged submarines and open up more radio and TV bandwidth to plug COPE to the Eskimos. Not really sure whether that part of the project ever really developed, but it's still under construction.
Well, we hear things about weather control connected with that.
Right. The primary reason for that is because the basic patents that the project is built on talk about weather control as one of the things that this gizmo could be used for.
Then of course, when you mention that, the next doesn't take a big leap to get to the hurricane season and how much it's been accented. And how these hurricanes are becoming, more damaging every year, it appears.
Right.
So is somebody sitting in a control room someplace moving these hurricanes about?
It's possible, but not very likely. I've talked with the inventor of HAARP at some length, and he is quite convinced that at the way HAARP is currently constructed, the size of the antenna field, it's an antenna field in southeastern Alaska, that the antennas are so linked together as to work as one giant antenna. And he says it's simply not big enough to be able to do the kinds of weather effects he describes in his patent. His patent is for a field of antennas 40 miles on a side, and HAARP is only 1,000 feet by 1,200 feet, and that's when completed, and it isn't completed yet.
So this story about it creating earthquakes and all the tsunamis and hurricanes and tornadoes, probably not true.
Probably not true. It's very interesting. The first book on the subject was Nick Begich and Gene Manning's book, Angels Don't Play This HAARP. And in that, it's a very simple book, a very short focused book. They set out to prove that it's a military operation, and they had the focus that civilian good, military bad. They prove it's military, it's bad. That's all there is to it. And that's where my book, HAARP, the Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, begins, in that I recognize the military is just a machine. You know, it's like a bulldozer. A bulldozer doesn't decide which pile of dirt to push over, and the military doesn't
what about the politics? I mean, are we using it for mind control, world domination? What are we doing with HARP?
Well, one of the things that struck me about HARP was that it's designed to bathe the world in ELF, extremely low-frequency radio waves, that at exactly the same frequency that the human brain works at. And my first thought was, after having studied mind control since the 1970s, my first thought was, if these guys have no clue what they're doing, they could inadvertently, unintentionally, cause road rage across half the planet. And if they did know what they were doing, this could be the ultimate mind control device. Nick Begich, in his book, he says HARP is a ground-based Star Wars weapon system. In my book, I spent about 40 pages on the history of mind control and showed that it's possible that that could be where they're going with it.
So you're not buying that it's a coincidence that it happens to be that frequency.
Right. Well, oddly enough, Nick and I have switched positions. I'm now convinced it's a ground-based Star Wars weapon system, and he's now convinced it's a worldwide mind control device, which I think is hilarious.
Well, it is interesting.
Uh-huh.
How would that work, this mind control device? Somebody would get into the frequencies and say to the population that's being affected, go do this. It's time to go to the movies. It's time to, how would that work? What would be the advantage of having millions of puppets?
One of the ways I saw that it could work was if we know that the military scientists have been working on voice to skull for 30 years now. They've been working on ways to put words and pictures into people's heads. If HARP can do that, HARP can put words in people's heads, there is a project or an idea for how to take over an enemy that was has been discussed since World War II. The head of Colgate College psychology department proposed to the U.S. Army that they could create he could create an army of sleepers, that he could put together 100 or 200 doctors, dentists who could go to the enemy country, work as doctors and dentists in this enemy country, and secretly hypnotize everybody in the country, or everybody who comes to them for medical,
sure,
hypnotize them into being a sleeper cell. That when they get the action phrase, they would go out and blow up a bridge or put poison in the drinking water or whatever. And there was always this problem of how do you get the message to your sleepers? There was a Charles Bronson movie based on this called Telephone.
Mm-hmm.
Telephone.
Yeah.
In which he gets his message and he goes out and kills people. Well, how do you get your entire army of sleepers instantaneously? If HARP can put words in people's heads across the planet simultaneously, that's your system.
Well, yeah, you just buy some commercials on CNN. it's phenomenal, and we make jokes about these things, but they are far out, but many of these things might actually be going on. What do you think?
Well, what I think is that the scientific literature says that science has been considering how to do this. The U.S. Patent Office has patents filed on how to do it. The technology exists. The science exists. It's simply a matter of, are they doing it or not?
And what do you think?
I don't know. I don't have any evidence one way or the other. I've got the same problem with chemtrails. The chemtrails could indeed be a spraying program. There certainly is an abundance of scientific literature discussing doing it. Don't look under chemtrails. If you're going to go Google, don't Google chemtrails. You just get all the Chicken Little websites saying the sky is falling. The way to get it is Google geoengineering. The word geoengineering will bring up hundreds of scientific documents and articles on changing the Earth's albedo, which is the amount of sunlight it reflects, changing the albedo by making the sky more reflective will reduce, in theory, the effects of greenhouse gases and global warming. And there has been a tremendous amount of discussion of this. Edward Teller, the father of the atomic bomb, wrote an article in Wall Street Journal urging that we do this.
Now, when we talked to you about some of these subjects, you've discussed a lot of them. I think you wrote your book on HAARP, back in 1998 originally, right?
Exactly. It was published in 98. I did most of the research in 96. And the Spear book came out in Secrets of the Holy Lands came out in July last year. And most of the research was done in the previous year.
You know what I'm going to ask you next. What are you working on now?
At this exact moment, I am working on a follow-up book on the HAARP, to the HAARP book. And this book is Weather Warfare, the Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature.
Well, there seems to be some evidence that is happening. It's being taken seriously.
It does indeed.
And we've had many stories about unexplained anomalies of weather, and many of them near military base installations and things like that, especially in England and a couple other places. I'm sure you've been investigating quite a few of those.
Exactly.
You think nothing is sacred with the military mind? I guess, in other words, If we could take it and make a weapon out of it, we'll do it, right?
Exactly. I mean, the purpose of HAARP is to find out if they can weaponize the atmosphere. I believe wholeheartedly that any piece of science that can be turned into a weapon sooner or later will be turned into a weapon. It's simply a matter of the acquisition cycle. It's simply a matter of does some battle planner sitting in an office in the Pentagon decide we need a gadget that does X. Where do we find it? That's apparently how the HAARP started.
Yeah, especially that. I think that's the way they work all the time. We're talking with Jerry E. Smith, author and lecturer, vice president for marketing and public relations and product development for Adventures Unlimited Press. Product development. What do you mean by that?
Finding new books for us to print. Basically, I'm a glorified first reader. When somebody wants us to publish their book, I get it first.
Let's talk a little bit about, before we go, UFOs and Area 51. And do you think the ETs are among us? Have we had contact?
Oh, boy, that is such a hard question. Now, I was the executive director of the National UFO Museum in Reno, Nevada.
Yeah, I noticed that in your resume.
I'm almost convinced that the Roswell event was an ET crash. There have been so many people come forward with so many pieces of the story over the years that I'm something definitely happened, and it wasn't test dummies falling out of balloons backwards for 8 years. You know, the Air Force, this is hilarious, you know, the Air Force trots out some general who says that the Roswell crash was some test dummies we dropped out of balloons in 1954, but Roswell happened in 1948. and when he's confronted with this in the middle of his press conference, he babbles there must have been some time compression and gets off the stage as quickly as
possible. Oh, he actually said that.
Yeah.
Well, we're doing quite a few shows on insider disclosure now, and we have a lot of people saying they have seen extraterrestrial bodies and living entities, so who knows?
Right. I tend to take Jacques Vallée's point of view that there are between 1 and 10 million reported sightings every year in the United States. That translates to between 10 and 100 million sightings per year around the world. And if you got 100 million sightings per year around the world, that is an awful lot of people seeing something. And if those somethings were all extraterrestrials, we would be up to our armpits in little bucks.
Well, many of them probably are phenomena of all kinds, but my conclusion is that maybe there's not one, not ten, but many extraterrestrials visiting our planet, and they may or may not be in harmony.
Exactly. That's a very definite possibility.
How about Area 51? You done anything on that?
A little bit. Area 51 was a hot happening in the early 90s when I was when we were doing the UFO Museum. So
yeah, that's the reason I brought that up.
I had a lot of contact.
You weren't that far away.
No, in fact, I live in Reno, Nevada, which is about a 6-hour drive north of Area 51. We do a weekly TV show on cable. That the host of the TV show, his mother is the mayor of Rachel, and the owner is a little alien.
Yeah, Pat?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we do, I know a lot about what's going on down there, and best I can tell, nothing is going on down there at this point in time. It just got too hot, it got too famous, too noticed, there were too many people trying to climb the fences, and they just said, screw this, and pulled out. And they've moved just about all of the exotic stuff out.
Where do you think they moved it?
I do not know, and I don't want to know.
Okay.
I tell everybody I know nothing secret. I want to know nothing secret. I don't want to be a problem because I don't like getting whacked.
Why the secrecy for 60 years like over Roswell?
Well, many reasons.
I can't think of one.
Well, one is if you screw up, you don't like to admit to having screwed up.
Well, I guess that's a human, but we're talking about people, great-grandfathers now, that screwed up.
Well, a lot of people near their deathbed have come forward about it.
Oh, we have an incredible show coming up in May with a man who was there and actually did all of the archiving, and he's nobody else knows about it.
Part of the secrecy is may well be that they considered that it would tumble society if we.
Well, you talk about that, and we have this raging value or battle of ideas now in the community over religious issues, which is too bad in my opinion. It seems to me that we're heading right back toward the dark ages almost.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that this is feeding upon itself, and it might be a relief to everyone if they found out there were other beings. In other words, I can't see this as being a legitimate argument, even though I'm sure it is. It just appears to me that we're headed toward a religious war in this country. It takes two to fight, and we're doing our part. And we need to stop that, and maybe disclosure would stop it in its tracks.
It's possible.
And that's the argument I'm using, and I'm trying, and I'm making a little headway, by the way. The point is, this is so much bigger than you, me, or anybody. I don't know that there'll ever be an official disclosure, except when everybody is ho-hum and thinks, well, yes, sure. And I think the population's almost to that point.
There has been a lot of softening up. I mean, there have been endless movies and TV shows about alien invasion, about good aliens and bad aliens, from Third Rock from the Sun to ALF.
Yeah.
They may well be trying to get us to the point where they could come forward.
And then that leads to the question, why did War of the Worlds suddenly take a twist where they're eating everybody? In other words, I think the extraterrestrials, that may be the little hidden agenda of many of them, cattle mutilations, human mutilations, etc., etc. But that's another subject we'll discuss some other time. I want to push your book again, and they have a link on the website there to get it. It's a very interesting read. And Jerry Smith, anything else you want to close out with?
No, not really.
Okay.
We've we've covered most of the topics I have an interest in. I guess the bell I want to ring the loudest here is look out for sustainable development. Sustainable development is the code word for the it is the new world order of the 21st century. It is the vehicle by which they are going to give us a global government.
And how would that work?
Well, what they're doing is through things like the Kyoto Protocols, they are creating a set of regulations about what about our lifestyle. We have to change our lifestyles in order to meet the Kyoto numbers. And what that means is they are ramping up to create a global police state to force us to change our lifestyles.
You think they're using environmental issues to do something else?
Exactly. They're not.
Why would they do that?
The whales. They're doing it because they're control freaks. That's what they do. They like power. They like.
Who are they?
Well, about 3% of the human family. You take any 100 people and put them in a room.
I must tell you, I understand what you're saying, and I do think you're correct in many ways. But the other side of that coin, nationalism against globalism, nationalism is far worse. We fought wars, people have died, people are doing everything. The world, in my opinion, shouldn't be any different between going to Illinois to Missouri. And we try to put up all these false barriers, trying to say that there's a terrorism deal when there's not, and et cetera. I mean, you know, there may be 5,000 people on camels, but they can't swim over here.
Right. Well, in theory, I agree with you completely. You know, I was a globalist. I was, as a youth, I was a member of the World Federalist Association.
Okay, why did you change your mind?
Well, when I saw the people in charge, and when I listened to the people.
Well, you ought to go visit the other camp.
You know,
you ought to go down to the super church down the street, and you ought to go over here to a neoconservative meeting, and you might see there's even more horrors.
Oh, I agree. There is no end of problems.
I think the best thing for us to do is all get informed, and unfortunately, we have more mechanisms for information now than ever before, and people know less.
That is so true.
I'll talk to you later, Jerry. I've enjoyed it.
This city's gonna tear you down, gonna take your world apart. You're passing down the runway to your hustle down the boulevard. The 14 has come and gone, you're a bitch and here tonight. And the vice ring is around your neck. I'm gonna take what's mine. This world goodbye. Hollywood's taking up the best years of your life. This world.